Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Daebak Podcast, where we do a deep dive into the classic Korean dramas that have won over generations of fans across decades and around the world. Discussing Reply 1988, the 2015 drama that is the third installment of the Reply series and an enormous hit in Korea. I'm one of your hosts, Alisa, also known as the Bollywood Newbie on Twitter, and I'm joined by Melanie of Pardesi Reviews on YouTube.
Hello.
Vicky of That Vicky Girl, also on YouTube.
Hello.
And Catherine of TotallyFilmy.com.
Hi, everyone.
So we haven't recorded in a couple of months, and I wish our listeners kind of wish they had heard the comedy that was going on just before we went on here for recording, because nobody knows, or at least I don't know how to operate technology anymore, apparently. So that's kind of a drag, but it's good to be back. Even though I talk to you ladies literally every day on Twitter, but it's not the same as seeing your faces and getting into it on a drama. So everybody's like posing with their aigo, with finger hearts. So we're doing good. So while we were away, what dramas did you guys really enjoy watching during the break? Like, what were some of your faves that you would recommend to other people?
The one that I really enjoy is kind of a weird way to put it, but The Smile Has Left Your Eyes was one that you got into.
Yes.
And I mean, that's because we all fell for Song Eun-guk after Doom at Your Service. And then we were all like, what else has this guy done? And you found The Smile Has Left Your Eyes. And it's, I'm not going to say it's a light drama, but wow, it was up there with My Mister with the acting and the writing of that series. It's one that I had never heard about, and I was so glad that you brought it to my attention. And of course, Vicky and I are right into Home Ta Cha Cha Cha. Like, we're in it every week.
yes.
And this is Alisa. I am not on Hometown Cha 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 train. Sorry. However, The Smile Has Left Your Eyes was definitely, oh my gosh, it's in my top three dramas now. It was really amazing. It's very dark, but very, very well done. And it isn't a drama you hear about a lot. I think it's really underrated.
It is.
So I'm going to do my little plug to say to people, and Vicky and I talk about this a lot, like, please go watch it. Even though it's dark.
Go watch it for Claire Skin. For 4.0 yeah. GPA.
Definitely, yes. The other drama I saw that I really loved was When the Camellia Blooms.
Oh, yeah.
It is, yeah. Yeah, one of Catherine's favorites, and she was surprised I liked it.
I was.
We were all surprised.
If you don't know, Alisa is known as the drop queen. We actually take bets on how many episodes it will take her to drop something that we've recommended.
Yes.
That is literally true. Yes. And you would think I have highfalutin taste, but you know, like, I've seen every version of Boys Over Flowers, so my taste is trash as anybody else's, but I am, like, you know, picky in a weird way. But When the Camellia Blooms was amazing. I mean, it has an incredible performance by Kang Han-nul as the male lead, and he won a Big Song Award for it, and it's just wonderful. And I compare it a lot with Hometown Cha-Cha-Cha because it's a small town story, but I think better done, in my opinion. Yes, yeah, sorry. I know Vicky's
Vicky and I are giving these faces like, hey
excuse
no.
me. I mean,
what do you say?
Okay, you cannot judge a drama just by the gifts that you've seen on Twitter, please. Okay.
Well,
we know you haven't started to watch it yet, so don't judge it. Don't judge it yet.
I saw episode one.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Well, that's fair.
Yeah, no. I tried it. I mean, I want it. That the thing is, like, I don't actually cruise around looking for dramas to hate. Nobody believes me. I want to like the dramas. I mean, when I like them, it's fun, right? But I just couldn't climb on the train on that one. And I like Kim Sun-ho a lot. as an actor. I think he's, and I love, and I don't know why, is it Shin Min-ah? I always remember
her. Yeah, Shin Min-ah.
I'm watching her now in A Wrong and the Magistrate, and she's awesome in that, and I'm really enjoying it. So I love the leads, but I just couldn't get into the writing, so.
Fair enough.
Anyway, anyway, Catherine, how about you? What did you watch this summer that you liked?
I started with Into the Ring because, and we've discussed this, I have a thing for sort of small political, not like big political, and you'd think I would hate that, you know, the day after we've had an election, but I like municipal politics where you have the underdog and the person who fights for the people, and Into the Ring has that, and it's impeccably written and it's a lot of fun. So then I went on to The City Hall.
That's a good one.
It was actually quite interesting, and I think it's unfair to compare it to Into the Ring simply because it comes from a period where you don't have the production values. But it was written by Kim Eun-suk, who and I loved this. So let's put it this way. Every writer might have something you really love. And I don't like her later works, but I really liked this little drama. Again, it's city municipal politics and the underdog who has to make her way in this world. It's an exact same kind of drama. And I loved both of those. I'm also working my way through Misaeng again. And this is from the same writer as Mayajishi. And it is, and it's the same kind of, if you love and yet also struggle with the emotions of that drama, Misaeng will be the same experience. But I love it. I really love it.
A dark drama I recently finished was DP or Deserter Police. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of happy-go-lucky rich father in Reply 1988 has a key role as Jung Kae-in's boss, you know, in the DP division. And then, you know, so there's another actor, I'm not going to necessarily spoil, but he who has a dark, very dark role in the first episode. And it was really surprising because it was very different than his turn in Reply 1988. But it was kind of jarring watching the two at the same time, because these actors were doing such very different roles, which just showed me that the range that they have. So DP is only 6 episodes. It's extremely dark. The trailer for it kind of showed some of the rare lighthearted moments, but very well, very worth seeing, and an examination of the hazing and the military culture and why these men are driven to desert in this compulsory military service that every man in Korea is obliged to do. So I admire Jung Hae-in for taking this role, and it's interesting. It's another Netflix series where I'm not sure, I think because they had Netflix, they had more freedom maybe to, if it had been on broadcast TV in Korea, I don't know if they would have been able to make some of the political points that they do in the drama.
Yeah, and the actor, by the way, is Go Kyung-pyo.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
And he portrayed Bora's boyfriend, fiance, in
right.
Reply 1988.
Yep.
So that was some good watching we did this summer, actually. As I think about it, there's some really good dramas out right now. But now I would like to do a quick intro to Reply 1988. But first, I just wanted to say that this episode is full of spoilers, as all of our episodes are full of spoilers, because we do a deep analysis, which requires spoilers. So if you haven't seen the show, you probably want to stop, go watch it first, and then come back and listen to what we have to say about it. Reply 1988 is the third installment in the popular and critically acclaimed Reply series, and 1997 and 1994 aired first. All three installments take a nostalgic look back at Korean history and pop culture. Reply 1988 aired from 2015 to 2016 and received both critical and audience acclaim, with its final episode recording an 18.8% nationwide audience share, making it the fourth highest rated drama in Korean cable television history. The show also won Baek-sang Awards for Best Director Shin Won-ho and Best New Actor Yoo Jun-yo. Reply 1988 tells the story. My folks are laughing because I practiced that name so much.
No, it's because Vicky and I were doing like hands up for our guy.
Anyway. Oh, that's right. You guys are fanning him right now. I completely forgot about that. They're watching him in Lost and they love him. Anyway, Reply 1988 tells the story of five friends and their families living in the same neighborhood of Sangmyeongdong in Seoul at a pivotal point in Korean history. The show stars a large cast of young actors, many of whom went on to big careers and international fame. They include Lee Hyeri as Song Deok-son, Park Bo-gum as Choi Tae-ik, Yoo Jong-yeol as Kim Jong-hwan, Go Kyung-pyo as Song Son-woo, Lee Dong-hui as Yoo Dong-hyun. So those are the five friends portrayed in the drama, but the show also has a cast of well-known character actors portraying the parents, and they include Song Dong-il as Deok-son's father, Lee Il-hwa as Deok-son's mother, and Kim Son-young as Son-woo's widowed mother, who... she's a favorite of the podcast. We freaking love her to death. So we're always excited. She was in Crash Landing on You, Romance is a Bonus Book.
Her private life,
you know, and just on and on and on. And then she always elevates everything that she is in. So usually when we choose a drama to discuss on this show, we look at whether the show is a classic or has the potential to become a classic in the future. And Reply 1988 definitely is a contender to become a classic. If you can, maybe you can even say it already is a classic given the popularity of the show many years after it's aired. But the way we got into this show was a little bit different. We actually started out by thinking of doing a food related episode because food and eating together is such an important part of Korean dramas, and we wanted to look at why that is. And in a typical podcast, I'm sorry, I'm going to be a little shady. Like, they all go, oh, that food looks so delicious. It's called baekbokki. It's called, you know, whatever the other names of the foods are. And that's fun to do. But we kind of wanted to do something a little bit different. So we wanted to, for example, look at things like, why are there so many dramas where a character will dramatically announce, I'm buying you meat. And everybody gets super excited about it. And it's considered a sign of someone's regard or a very special treat. Or, you know, what's the significance when an ajumma makes huge bins of banjeon, which are the side dishes, and kimchi for loved ones to take home? But when we started to dive into the topic, it opened up into something much, much bigger than we were expecting, and basically encompassing Korean economic and political history and the absolutely massive changes the country has gone through over the past 40 years. So as you can imagine, we felt a little daunted by this, right? Like, how do we get our arms around this? We don't exactly know how we want to talk about this. And then Vicky watched and fell in love with Reply 1988. And we realized that the show encapsulates everything we wanted to cover in this episode. And we also think that this is one of the reasons why this show will end up or could end up becoming an enduring classic, because it does kind of capture some very important things about Korea and the changes that the country has gone through. So we're gonna dive into a very brief history lesson. Please stick with me. I know it's like, oh my God, this is supposed to be a fun podcast. Why are you giving me history? But it's important, bear with me. So, in the early 1960s, Korea was one of the poorest nations in the world with a gross, what is GDP again? I'm sorry.
Gross domestic product.
Thank you. Gross domestic product per capita of $158. So essentially, like, that was the equivalent of the annual income of the average Korean was around $158. But by 1988, it had increased by 2,887%. Let me repeat that. 2,887% increase in 20 years. And like today, South Korea has the 12th strongest GDP in the world. In addition, there was massive migration from rural areas to urban areas. So like in 1960, 72% of the population of Korea lived in rural areas. By 1988, when the show is set, 65.4% of the population lived in cities, and that grew to 82.3% by 1996. So basically, in less than 30 years, you had millions of people move from their small villages in the countryside into these massive cities. In addition, 1988 was the year of the Seoul Olympics, which placed the country on an international stage for the first time and is considered a marker of Korea entering the modern era. And 1 year before the show is set, there were nationwide mass protests against the military government that existed at that time that led to the establishment of today's Democracy of South Korea. So this is a really important era in Korea's history. It's a huge amount of economic, political, and social change in a short time. And all of that change is illustrated in Reply 1988 in one way or another. So we do have some recommendations for reading if you want to learn more about the history and the economic changes that have happened in Korea. But now Elise is going to shut up because I've been talking a lot, and I'm going to throw it to my podcast partners to take it away from here. So who wants to go next?
So what she was talking about, the change from most of the population of Korea living in villages in the country to moving into the cities is exemplified by the parents' generation and Reply 1988. They have, in a way, recreated their village in their alleyway, in their complex of houses and apartments. And they treat each other the same way of sharing food, communally preparing food together. You know, when Tuck's dad becomes a widow, you know, his friend from the village that he grew up with encourages him to move to Seoul to be with their friend group, since he has a young son the same age as so many of the kids in the neighborhood. And so it really, you know, we get a glimpse of where the parents have come from. There's a funeral scene. There's a, you know, the grandmother of Duck's son, the one girl of the friend group. Her grandmother passes away in one of the early episodes, and we see them go back to the village and, you know, where they had come from to, you know, and then now all of them live in Seoul. So, and of course, I mean, spoiler, the very end of the series is that everyone moves up and moves on from that alley, and they kind of lose that togetherness that they had. But you know, for that moment they were all together, and even though there's different levels of wealth within the small alleyway, everyone is still sharing with each other in a kind of a way that reminds me of what, you know, country village life must have been like. Well, I made soup, here everyone share it. Or the family that's wealthy enough is the one that orders the fried chicken or the pizza or whatever to share with everyone else.
I was also struck by like how not only do like every family feeds every kid, like when a dinner is made, every kid in the community eats, but it's also they're literally eating from the same bowls. They don't even parcel it out into separate plates. It's like they plop the pan of kimchi fried rice on the table and everybody digs in with their spoons from the same pan. So that, yeah, this sense of community and sharing everything. And I think that's like a big part of the appeal of the show. And Vicky, I would actually love for you to weigh in on this, because I know that you got very emotional when you were watching this show, and it's a favorite of yours. And so I'd love to hear what you think about this.
Yeah, the appeal that you just mentioned is exactly why the show made me cry. It made me cry at the end. I'm not gonna lie, I definitely cried. Like, I actually shed tears, mainly because I grew up back in Ghana in a similar environment where almost everyone in that neighborhood kind of was like, you know, the aunties or whoever, they were almost like your second mom. And if they made dinner, you know, you went there and you had dinner too. The kids played together when dinner time was, you know, when it was time for dinner, you went home, you got food. Or sometimes what some of the adults would do is they would kind of get a big bowl, just like you mentioned, with them all eating together, and just give it to the kids and we would just eat together. So that nostalgia was really, 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 really hard for me watching, because it just reminded me, because eventually I moved from there when I was 7. And it's funny because I also kind of felt the same experience as I moved here too, because the neighborhood I moved to, it was like I had kids my age as well, especially my preteen years. We were all together, and at some point everyone has all left except me, so I'm like the only one stuck in the alleyway in a way. And so it was just beautiful, and in its own little way, even though it was set in Korea, even though, you know, it obviously had cultural elements that I couldn't relate to, there was some backstories, and there were some you know, just the idea of family, the idea of friendship, the idea of love lost was just really appealing to me. And that's just something that I will always remember this show for. And I love it very much for that. So,
and I've told my podcast partners that I'm going through something this week, and that my best friend is moving to another state. And our youngest sons are the same age. We live a block apart, so we're in the same neighborhood. My son never rang their doorbell. He knew the code to get into their garage. He would never knock. He would just come in. He would just, you know, and literally, you know, we had a discussion on, could you not know where your son was? Well, it was that kind of relationship that every weekend, either he was sleeping over there or her son was sleeping at my house. And if I went to bed early, literally I'd wake up and I'd be like, oh, Ben isn't here. He must have slept over at Liz's house. I need to call him to come over and get dressed for Sunday school or whatever. So, I mean, I didn't even worry because I knew he was at the neighbor's. So, and that is passing this week because she's moving away. And so we're losing that community feel that we had in our neighborhood. So yeah, it is, it even, I think, and if you didn't have it, I think you would watch this show and wish that you had not just one mother and father, but a whole neighborhood of aunties and uncles that were taking care of you and watching out for you.
And it also makes you look at the things that you might have taken for granted as well, even if you experienced something like that growing up, you know, just seeing how much they all hold dear. And just especially the ending part where she kind of says, you know, you don't realize these things once you get older. And then you realize that this moment that you had with these group of people were so meaningful. And it's not until, you know, they're all away and everybody's gone that you realize, oh, wow, we had some good times. And, you know, at that time, it's kind of, time is gone. And you're just stuck with the memory. So I thought, yeah, that was just kind of my take. I thought it was a beautiful journey. In that aspect.
What did you think, Catherine?
I can only echo what both Vicky and Melanie said. I mean, I grew up in a neighborhood in Toronto, suburban Toronto in Canada. And at the time my parents bought their house, there was like nothing there. And it was fields, and they were building these new homes, and it was a very much a working class neighborhood. And we had sort of the same little strip on the street where all the kids were about the same age. We were always, you know, in each other's houses. I also had the advantage that I had several aunts and uncles who actually lived reasonably close by as well. So it was the same kind of situation. We were always, you know, and those scenes where in Reply 1988, where the mothers are all calling their kids to come for dinner. I mean, that's my childhood, you know, and we'll probably get into some of the other these things later, but I can really identify, I can see my mother in these mothers in this show. Whatever you think about that, but it's given me a little more appreciation. I think I've been, watching it again to to think about it for the podcast really got me thinking about my mother and how she was raised and how she, what was expected of her, and a little more appreciation for her, really.
Yeah, because we talked about, you know, the historical change of, you know, a lack of education, and then the children, this next generation, are expected to try to get into Seoul National University, right? So, you know, you go from the parents maybe partially literate to that, you know, and it, what a huge change that is over generation. And, you know, thinking about what kind of education did these parents have in the village, you know, especially the mothers, maybe they didn't have that much. There's one scene, Zheng Huan's mother is trying to get a passport because they're wealthy enough to visit Japan, but the travel agency keeps calling and wanting to know her English name for the passport. And she keeps diverting and she keeps sending her son, and he's calling her, he's like, "Mom, they need to know." And then she finally has to admit, "I can't read in English. I don't know what to put down," you know. So,
but not only that, and I wish it occurred to me as we were talking earlier today. So I can't pin down which of the mothers it is, and which it was one of the early episodes, but it's one of the mothers writes a note, and the camera pans to look at the note, and it's very much chicken scratch, and it's very evident that she can write in Korean, but not well. That hits home for me because that's my mother. My mother left school at 13. And she's very self-conscious about writing. And if she writes a note for us, she'll apologize for it. And I'm like, "Mom, please," like, I'm going to cry now. So the like little moments like that really hit home for me. And it's, and again, I mean, I'm a whole world away in Canada and in a completely kind of different culture, and yet completely connecting to this show on that level.
Yeah, I think there's something about a show like this that delves so much into the specificity and all of these small little moments. Really, this writer's style is creating these vignettes, these moments. It's not the kind of series where they are really consumed with, you know, so much plot has happened, you know, each episode. That's not what it is. We're just living life and all of these scenes of life with these characters. And I feel like this writer, because I just finished watching the second season of Hospital Playlist, which is her other more recent popular series. And it's these slice of life. I feel like, you know, this writer owns this genre. She sort of created this genre. All of these reply series, all of the Hospital Playlist series. And it's, you're falling in love with all these characters, and it's so much about the specificity of the characters and their lives. And you just want to live in that world. And I, you know, I can't even tell you, you know, what happened from episode to episode, but you know, I so richly know these characters and what they cared about, what they were afraid of, what they were fearful of happening in their life. You know, I know these characters, and that's the strength of this writer.
So I'm going to weigh in. here we go. I also grew up in a very similar community. I'm Puerto Rican, or rather I'm New Yorican, which is a slang word for somebody of Puerto Rican descent who grew up in New York City. My family, my mom was 5 when they arrived in New York in the 1950s, and they recreated their communities in New York. And it's a very similar situation where everybody from the same town would move on to the same block. So like my father's family lived on a street in the Bronx called Avenue St. John. And they literally, like the whole family, occupied 3 buildings on the block. And I was the 48th grandchild. My father was the youngest of 9 children. And everyone knew each other and everybody was in each other's business. And, you know, there is an appeal to that in the sense of this community of people who are looking out for you. You're getting fed emotionally and in other ways where people are rallying around you if you need help. My mother still lives in the same building she's lived in for 45 years. I recently visited her in New York with my son, and I, because I live in Los Angeles now, and an old woman came up to me and in Spanish said to me, "Is that Lucy's grandson?" Because she had recognized him from the photos that my mother had shown her. So I totally get the appeal of that on one level. I personally, growing up, did not experience that in a positive way. I experienced it in a really oppressive way. I mean, it's like, to be blunt, I found it very stifling, because in those communities can also be very rigid and very judgmental. And they can be, especially for women, problematic in terms of what's allowed for a woman to do and the very narrow parameters of what's acceptable in terms of mothering, in terms of career, relationships with your husband, all kinds of things. So as I was watching Reply 1988, on the one hand, I was like, I get what the writer is portraying for us. I personally found it frustrating, because I know that there were things that were not kind of papered over and not portrayed very well. I mean, when you have like this massive change, first of all, if the small community rural life was so amazing, why did they go to the city, right? I mean, there's a reason why that massive migration, there's a reason why millions of people made that move. There's a reason why my family went from Puerto Rico to New York. There were real realities in those communities that were very, very difficult to deal with. People make those changes. And so, you know, we're talking about like the socioeconomic things that were going on in Korea that led to that migration. I kind of felt a lot of those things were very papered over, because it is a sentimental viewpoint of that way of life. Something that bothered me a lot. So Bora participates in student protests. Those protests were incredibly important to the history of Korea. They literally overturned the government. They literally led to the establishment of the democracy that exists in Korea today. And it felt like the show almost treated her political aspirations in a very condescending way. Like it was like a childish infatuation she was having that wasn't very serious, and she needed to get over it so she could get back on track with her education and with marrying the boy next door. And it bothered me. I'm coming at this from a very specific point of view too, though, because I work with people. I have worked on political campaigns. I've done, you know, social justice work and such. So I tend to take that stuff seriously. And I didn't really like how the show kind of, I don't know, in my opinion, but kind of brushed that away in a way that I found very unsatisfactory. And I think that's just a good example of some of my frustrations with the show. And
well, you know, yeah, I didn't feel like her parents were pushing her to get married. I kind of, on the contrary, they were, wait a minute, we've invested all of this in your education. Yeah. You were the smart one of the family. Wait, what? You know, yeah. you want to get married now? So I didn't feel that she got those pressures, but I did feel like they dealt with the student protests in a very cursory way. It was over a couple of episodes. We get to see Bora's father rescue another student protester and pretend to be his father or something on the street to save him from the police. And there's one moment where we get to see Bora's mother rescue her from arrest, or confront the police and you know, defend her daughter and try to rescue her. So there's kind of, you know, it's more that the parents are worried, you know, that our daughter is sneaking out, instead of really grappling with all the changes that are happening. And why is, you know, we never really hear, why does Bora care about this? Why, you know, it's more shown as like these teenage hijinks that she's sneaking out to rebel, not that she's doing something momentous. And it's just this big dark secret that she keeps from everyone in the whole neighborhood, not just in her family. So I don't know. I don't know enough about that period. I kind of wanted to know more. I guess I'm going to have to seek it out through other films or shows.
Youth of May is there if you kind of want to get a glimpse of that as well. I will suggest that show. It was, get ready for it, because it was definitely sentimental, especially the end. But to piggyback off of what you were talking in regards to Bora and the whole aspects of it. For me, you guys mentioned, they did brush it off, but I took it as perhaps the writer just didn't want to get into that aspects of politics, because that particular topic, I'm not well informed, but it is a really big deal, you know? And so perhaps it was something that she wanted to mention because it was going on during that time. So it was like to touch it briefly, like, yeah, there is somebody in this neighborhood who obviously was, you know, that thing was happening, but they're just not going to delve into it. I also think they wanted to look at it from a perspective of the parents and her loved ones, in the sense of, while she was doing this, you know, this campaign, and she was being political, she was taking a stand, it was hurting her parents. She was hurting. She was getting arrested. You know, she could potentially get killed. And so I think that the story went on that aspect to show you of, as a worried parent, that you don't want your kid to do something like this, not because you don't care of the cause, but because it could potentially harm them. And so I think that's kind of the route they went with Bora's situation. And obviously, if you want to know more about the situation, you're not going to like it, because you wanted to know, like, and you definitely wanted to see her kind of, you know, do it and take a stand. But I also think that it's okay. I think you can, Bora could have been political and marry the guy next door. She could have done both. And perhaps she chose the safer route for her life, maybe, or maybe her parents did. Who knows who, you know, the influence that she had eventually. But sometimes in life, it's not always, there's certain things you make because you want to live or you want to survive. And some people die for what they believe in and others don't. And perhaps, you know, this was just one of those cases where the author or the writer just felt like, all right, you know, or you took a stand, but life, you gotta live, and you the societal pressure, you unfortunately, you gotta fold and become a woman, you gotta do what you gotta do, you gotta eventually get married. But I definitely do agree with Melanie that I didn't feel that her parents were forcing her to get married. In fact, I thought it was the opposite, you know, in some instances. So, but it's interesting to see from that perspective, though.
I felt like either, like, if they could have simply, like, showed it as news stories, or maybe hearing the protests or the father passing, maybe just have that scene with the father rescuing the student. But once they got Bora as part of that story, and there was a scene with her mother saving her from the cops, what actually happens is Bora feels like becomes the filial daughter and does the thing that is going to be the safest, because that means she's a good daughter. And that's where I got, it bothered me. This is just a personal thing. It bothered
me. Let me just say, the way they set up Bora's character, this is not someone that I view gave up on law school. In fact, she breaks up with the boyfriend, I think, because she just wants to concentrate on her studies. And she became a prosecutor or a judge. I mean, I have no doubt about it. This is not a stay-at-home mom kind of a character. And this is one thing I want to say is that, you know, I do hear the criticism of the way women in the series are portrayed, although some of it is just the time that it was. It was a time of bad perms and all sorts of other bad things. But I've been thinking about the fact that so many other Korean dramas kind of give us milquetoast female leads. You can't say that about this show. I mean, we've got Bora, and we've got Deuk-san she's not milquetoast. She's not bland. You know, she has a lot of personality. So I do have to give it up to Reply 1988 for that.
I didn't think her parents forced her to get married, but it was more like how the writer of the show pairs up every single person with somebody in the alley. Like, they all end up marrying somebody they met living in the alley.
And that's the Reply series.
Yeah,
it is. No, totally. But I mean, that's a choice, right? I mean, she's making a choice about how she wants to portray this, and it's communicating something. Yeah. You know,
and in hospital playlist, everybody marries off another doctor or whatever. It's all within the hospital.
It can happen, though. In reality, you do see it happen. I mean, granted, it can be a bit cliche, but it's something that happens. And so, and looking at the way the story was told, I mean, it was obvious that this was what was going to happen. I mean, the way they were all close, I mean, and it's not like they were really young. They were also in teenage years. And, you know, a lot of those things stick with you, that you make a lot of good friends at that age as well. So I feel like it was bound to happen. And it, even if it didn't happen, somebody, two of them, at least, which is kind of what happened, is eventually going to end up dating at some point. And so, yeah, but that's the reply series.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Duck Sun character being a middle child. Uh-huh. And I don't know that I would have clued in as much to how, especially in the first few episodes, because Alisa was watching this series, I think, a little bit ahead of me, and she was outraged at the way the family was treating this middle child so unfairly. But literally, when at a breakfast, there are only two eggs for three children, this mother does not cut up the eggs to distribute them fairly. The oldest daughter, the smart daughter, gets a fried egg. The youngest son, the treasured son of the family, gets an egg, and the middle child gets nothing. She just gets, rice gets or
kimchi
whatever.
Kimchi and rice.
Kimchi
and
rice.
I just want to pause for a second,
She gets beans.
Right. So the thing is, I just want to pause for a second because this is not an insignificant choice, right? Okay. Like protein is actually incredibly important and in short supply at that time and expensive. And so the family basically made a decision to nourish two of their children more than the one they thought wasn't going to be a good investment. And the other thing is that, because there's a chicken that gets divvied up and they get the Bora and her brother get the legs and Doksong gets the wings.
The wings.
Like she is just, and it's like, we have limited resources and we're not going to invest them in you because you're a girl and you're not smart like your sister, so you don't get anything. I mean, that's like, I was really shocked. And I know other people don't take that as seriously as I did, but I was like, people in Korea got taller when they got more protein. The high average height of Koreans, and I don't have the stat in front of me, but it increased dramatically once people had more access to protein. So it's not a small thing to divvy up the eggs and the chicken in that way. Like you're actually really disadvantaging one of your children by doing that. I was like, wow. And it's played for laughs. I was really taken aback by that. I don't know. It bothered me.
I'm not disagreeing that she is a little hard done by as the middle child, but I jokingly mentioned the beans, but beans and rice make a protein. She's not getting the highest quality protein, but she is getting something. But yes, but
I mean,
yes,
they're not starving her to death and throwing her in the street still.
No, but
can you imagine being that child and you're looking at your siblings chomping down on literally the better food than you while you're sitting there with the inferior food that your parents have given you because they don't think you rate the better food.
And it's something that the other neighbors know about, because at one point the rich dad, Jung Kwan's dad, tries to give her, you know, fried chicken that he's picked up. Here's extra that I bought for your family. Make sure you get a breast, right? Like he and it ends up that she doesn't get it. You know what I mean? So, and then when she's at somebody else's house, I can't remember how many scenes there are of her gorging down food, you know, or if the rich family is serving meat, you know, she's just like, you know, she hears, oh, you're having, marinated ribs for breakfast. I'll stay, you know, and then she's and there's so many scenes of her gorging herself and the other kids just kind of looking at her like, whoa, you know,
what goes on?
it's not something that's just a secret within their family. Everybody kind of knows, but that's one thing is that I saw that, you know, so that's a negative, definitely. But there was so much sharing of food. Everybody knew Duck Sun's family was the poor family of the neighborhood. And they went out of their way. That's true. And they went out of their way to share meat with them. you know, things that they couldn't afford. Oh, we're going to try spaghetti tonight. Spaghetti and meatballs. Everybody come over, you know, or we're going to order these new pizza thing. Like, everybody come over. So I did like just that sharing aspect, Tech, because he is this famous Bodic, you know, player, and he would get these fruit baskets, and literally we're shown that bananas are this rare luxury item for the kids to have. Both, you know, the widow's little girl, who was I think only like 5 or 6, you know, she craves bananas, but their family can't afford them. And so when Tech, you know, he shares these bananas from his fruit basket, but he doesn't care, like he's getting them all the time, but he shares them with the other families so that they can have that treat.
Yeah. And he's the one who buys the pizzas too, because he's got the money from his winnings.
Mm-hmm. And everybody hangs out in his room, which I thought
I
like.
The other thing that I found interesting is the lottery family has money, but they never forget that they were poor. And we and they are reminded of that several times. And I think that's probably why they're even more willing to share with everyone in the alley, because they know what it's like.
Yes.
You know, something that struck me, which I found really interesting though, is like they're the wealthy family in the alley, but they didn't earn their money. It was through a lottery. And I was wondering why the writer made that choice. And Melanie talked about this a bit before the
podcast. Yeah, because Duck Sun's friend with the braces, the girl who's from the wealthy family, she's, you know, she lives in this wealthy house, you know, somewhere else in another neighborhood. And we, until the very last episodes, we only hear her father as this very stern voice on the phone. And then we kind of learn, you know, she disappears and goes to the US to study and whatever. And then we learn that she's a little bit ashamed of her father, because He brought himself up by his bootstraps and has all of these fabric and tailoring stores. And he's a self-made man, but he still is rough around the edges. And it's a major scene when she introduces her boyfriend to him. But it's very different than the lottery family. I still don't quite understand what the dad of that family did. He had some sort of appliance store or something. I think it was to introduce the whole Gold Star brand thing and how that ultimately changed, but you know, I still don't quite get exactly what his job was. He went off somewhere to do something, but no,
I think you're right. He had an appliance store, because when Duck Sun's family, when their financial situation improves, they buy a gas, what do you call that?
A little cooker stove, yeah.
Yeah, the double hot plate gas. And they buy it from his store. He gives them a deal on it.
Right. And I do think the way that we know that their circumstances have completely changed, instead of showing that the family is suddenly wearing better clothing or driving a car, the way the director is showing that to us is that when before the father would complain, why isn't there was some sort of mussels or something that he liked to eat, and you know, very limited menu that they would have on their little table, and suddenly there are mounds of food, platters piled high with food, and the kids' eyes are just popping out. That's how they know is, wow, now we have food to eat as much as we want. And that's the show of how their financial, I never did really get exactly what the deal was. That, I mean, the dad was always loaning money and doing all sorts of crazy things, even though he worked at a bank. So that was a little strange, but somehow he had gotten swindled or something. And it was a little lost in translation for me exactly how their financial situation changed. But anyway, that's how we
signed for a debt for somebody. He agreed to back up somebody's debt, and then the person defaulted.
Yeah.
So, you know, and, but it was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And when their circumstances change, the fellow whose debt defaulted pays them back.
Yeah.
So finally they're not in debt anymore.
When you're touching on, so So like one of the things I was kind of struck by in the show is there's sort of the view of capitalism and money and how money gets made and how people achieve or don't achieve affluence. And when you look at the parents' generation, it feels very arbitrary. I mean, you win the lottery or you like get swindled by your friend and now you're broke. You know, like there's this weird sense of disconnect between the effort and the outcome. And you do have that one wealthy family, which is, you know, that they, I don't know, I think they sell fabric or I'm not sure what they sell, that were self-made. And in tech, I guess, is self-made because he plays Baduk and he's, you know, able to become rich and famous from that. But it's almost like, but I actually think that's significant because you had, Catherine, you had referred to this, that the IMF crisis was coming. And I don't know enough about that to speak to it, but I know that there was some kind of bank default in Korea that caused a huge economic upheaval a few years after the setting of the show, I guess.
Well, the show takes us up to about 1994.
So it would have been around that time.
So when in the early 90s, you had the beginnings of the financial crisis in Korea, particularly at that point in the banks. And they were doing things like offering, you know, voluntary retirement packages because they wanted to downsize.
Right.
But you had this sort of financial crisis brewing around the banks, which led to the IMF crisis in 1997, where the kind of the bottom dropped out of the economy.
Right.
Like I'm summarizing very surfacely as well, but that's the situation for Duxon's father and why he's, and I was, you know, through this show, I'm going, take the package deal because you they didn't know what the future would be.
But I think it's like, you know, an interesting point of view in the show, I think that's being communicated about, you know, you have these monetary changes, the country is becoming more prosperous, and yet there's winners, there's losers. And it feels like people don't really have control over whether or not they become a winner and a loser, which is a theme that comes up in other dramas constantly, I mean, including Squid Game, which is like the latest Netflix drama that kind of touches on this as well. Like who's a winner and who's a loser and why. And it's very like arbitrary.
Well, if you want a drama that sets you right into the IMF crisis, you've got Miss Korea. And that's very much what's happening. You've got, you know, they're trying to it's mostly, again, brief, the invention of BB cream, which now is like so integral to K-beauty. But it came out of a German dermatologist created this kind of lighter foundation cream for like acne patients. And you have, you know, these guys in Korea trying to formulate this so they can sell it on the market. And that's the situation around, you know, Miss Korea. And it's very much like they're talented and they work hard, but it's a crapshoot.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's just a theme that comes up over and over again. And it definitely comes through. And I think another thing, as we're talking about this, like the idea of like, they've got this little enclave that is safe and nurturing, but there's this swirl of things in the outside world around them and that, you know, are threatening in some way.
And while we see some of this filtered through every single parent, except for Tech's father, feels that education is the only way, is the only path. And the amount of time that these kids spend studying was just mind boggling. You know, they're at these study booths or whatever until 11 at night or something. I mean, it's just some crazy, it was just crazy to me that they were, you know, they had their dinner that they had brought to school, you know, to have. It wasn't just their lunch pail. It was their dinner pail to have. And then they were going to have more studying. And so the fact that Dexon was not a good student, even though at times in the drama, she was trying hard. Sometimes she wasn't because she just didn't know what she wanted to do with her life versus some of the other characters that were so driven. You know, we see Jung-kwan, he's almost extra driven to excel because his parents have kind of their older son is that we learn he had a heart condition, but has failed the college entrance exam like 7 or 8 times. I mean, it's just this running thing through the whole thing that, you know, so all the family's hopes are pinned on him, the younger son, to be the one that goes to university. And it's just such an emphasis on education for the kids. Like, this is the only path. There is no other path. You have to just get into that top university. And if you don't, then they can't even imagine what else that they could do with their lives.
And I don't, that's not just from the parents, because from what I understand, the government also heavily pushed that as well, like trying to raise the literacy rate of the country and a huge emphasis on education. So yeah, that was a big deal in that time. But yeah, it's just kind of thinking about it, you know, like you have this community and they're looking out for each other, but the winds of change are blowing and they can't stop it. They can't stop the community from dispersing. They can't stop things from breaking apart. I mean, there's this ideal, like we all married each other, but they're still scattered, you know, at the end.
Well, speaking of that, so getting into the love triangle, which evidently the director of the series was a little annoyed that the audience focused in on maybe the most. And I have to admit, the will they, won't they kind of carried me through, because it's 20 episodes, people. And we're not talking 50-minute episodes. We're talking, I was joking that they were 3-hour episodes. It was more like each episode was at least 1.5 hours, sometimes more. I mean, they were lengthy episodes. And I don't know if the original series was meant to be 16 episodes and they stretched it to 20, you know, sort of like what happened with My Love from the Star got kind of stretched. I don't know. But it might have been, if you were watching it week by week, it might have had a different feel. I mean, I was trying to really watch it all at once, so it felt kind of long. But what kept me going was, who was that son going to end up with, you know, of the two friends? And Park Bo Gum plays Tech, and then, you know, mine, Jung Kwan, like that was the one guy that I was pulling for. But it was, Vicky, well, we were agreeing on this. It's you snooze, you lose. I mean, it's that second male lead syndrome where he doesn't, he hesitates and thus he loses. He doesn't express his feelings. And then that's shown that then you're not going to win the girl if you don't express your feelings and let them know.
And the way he expresses it, it's one that I honestly don't like, which is the good old, you're mean to the girl, you know, they tell you in elementary school, the guy that teases you kind of likes you type of mentality. And so even though he was a sweetheart, don't get me wrong, he had his moments where he would be mean to her and like, he'll treat her like crap. And obviously, I mean, I wouldn't like him, you know? So I think I knew early on that it just wasn't him. And so it made it easier for me to just be team Tech anyways, because I was just like, okay, I wasn't even on a team. The writers made me on a team, and that's why it's interesting to me that they were annoyed, because they kind of brought this on us in a way. Like, as the story goes, that's kind of what the main story was, wasn't it? Like, it starts with her with the guy, and then it's like, it's giving us all these Easter eggs to basically figure out which one is he. So,
including flashing forward to the future of them as a married couple in the future. And so we're trying to guess, okay, by the characteristics of him as an adult husband, which one is it? Catherine needs to leap in at this point.
there was a theory out there that she was supposed to end up with Kim Jong-hwan.
And I mean, because the first time we see the married husband, he's very sarcastic and he acts the same way as an adult as he did as a kid. And that's why I'm like, okay, that's the one.
I think they were trying to be tricky though.
I'm wondering about that, because
the smoking was the biggest indicator for me, going off of the smoke. And then you see Tech, and then you see him smoke, and then you see Jung. They were trying to go for it. Well, they started early on, because I mean, they were trying to be tricky, but the biggest indicator for me was the smoking, because never once did I see, at least going on, did I see Jung Kwan. And I mean, he could have picked it up as he got older, but I feel like that was like a staging point in some way. So I, that theory could be true, but I really think, I don't know. I really think it was tech from the beginning. Cause there were just Catherine's so many.
Right. I think Catherine's right. I think they changed their mind probably because Park Bo-gum became such probably a fan favorite. I mean, isn't this the show that really made him? Yeah. Okay. So I'm sure, I think Catherine is shaking her head. No. Yes.
But and look at the way they zoomed into Tech and Dok Sun's childhood. It was at some point where she basically took, I mean, some would say it's motherly love, but for me, I feel like that was her first love. She liked
him. No, I felt it was very motherly. Right, that's why I was like, she's just making sure he eats and he takes his pills.
But she didn't like Jonghyun until her friend said that he liked her. And that was her problem. She tended to
you
like
think
his
she
guy.
Didn't notice when his shirt ripped on the boss, please?
But she didn't. She
Vicky, come on.
No, I noticed.
I noticed.
Melanie was like, he's the one.
I don't think she liked him enough. Honestly, I don't think she liked him enough.
I think she was confused and she didn't know because he was so sarcastic and mean to her that she didn't even know. She didn't even know. But yeah,
I'm with you because from the beginning, I thought it was Tech because the other guy was too passive. And that passivity is just, Tech is a problematic character in some ways, but like at least always went for what he wanted. He went for the Baduk career and he was openly saying, I like her to his friends. I wasn't afraid to say it. I mean, to me, it was like really obvious that the writer was saying, yes, he's going to be the one from that.
But that is a shift because he's almost non-existent in the first few episodes.
Mm-hmm. Well,
she talks about him like 94/7. I mean, if anybody mentions Tech, it's Dok Sun. Almost every second, Tech will be, oh, tech. I mean, I get it. No, trust me.
But there are moments where the writers could have made a big moment. Let's think about when Jung-kwan meets her at the concert, there were moments that could have built and gone another direction. And that's so this was one of the most equal love triangles of any K-drama that I have seen, because it literally kept you guessing for almost 20 episodes of which way it was going to go.
It did.
Because, and I felt like the big speech that Jung-kwan gives, declaring his love, for those Indian fans, it was like the reading the diary in Kalnaho that Shah Rukh Khan does, where he pours out his feelings and then was like, yeah, it was a joke. But
she looks at the door half the time for Tech.
But I'm just saying they threw a crumb to us, okay? They threw a crumb to the other side, which a lot of dramas don't even do. So,
Boys Over Flowers has entered the chat, though. they had a wedding photo shoot with Ji-hook.
I give it up.
But your average everyday drama does not necessarily keep a love triangle to that level for that.
You know what's funny? I think it would have been predictable if it was Jung-kwan. In some ways, I really do think it would have been predictable, only because of it was the classic trope of mean guy, mean to you, loves you in the back, and it would have been very typical. So in some ways, which was, I mean, even though it sucks for you because you should.
But I mean, yeah, Tech becomes sort of the.
That is. Yeah. I was like, this is about who you shipped her with. I mildly was pro Tech just because he had more gumption to go after her, but I wasn't strongly on either side. And to me, it was blazingly obvious from the beginning that that's who
it
she
was. It was obvious
with.
To me, honestly. I don't know how y'all did it, but
I had no dog in this fight because I wasn't that invested either way.
But she saw it. See, Melanie? She saw it.
I saw it. You were blinded by the other guy's hotness.
Catherine, you've been watching dramas longer than some of us. So what do you feel like it was like when the show first aired? Was there a frenzy about it that people were of the different camps, or was everybody just totally shipping for tech, and that was it.
I'm going to argue for my position. No, and this is a theory that came out around the time that it was supposed to be one, and all of a sudden people flashed on Park Bo-gum, and the writers increased his, I'm coming at it too, because I've seen all three. I've seen 97, which 97 is the one I think that jerks you around the most with will she or who will she end up with. Mm-hmm. 94, I was convinced from the beginning she would end up with Trash. Oh. You will notice Trash makes an appearance at the end of 1988.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I heard the name and I saw you meant he was
Trash. Sideggy. Oh,
okay.
Sideggy is his nickname.
Oh, okay.
And in 1994, it's a choice between him and the pro baseball player. And everybody was shipping the pro baseball player because he's cute. And I was like, she's ending up with Trash.
It just sounds so funny. She's ending up with Trash.
But, and it's like, this is one of the things I do love about this series is, like, 94, you see the characters from 97 and 90 and 88, because they're taking us forward to 94. We see, I loved that. I loved that where Bora was supposed to be set up with the Dr. Trash. And they take the scene from Reply 94 where he has to go and rescue Gora. And it ends up with our doctor and our lawyer together in the end.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Well, Lisa did that at the beginning.
I'm watching 97 now, which I'm enjoying more than 88. I'm not saying it's better. I'm enjoying it more, so that's a difference. I mean, 88 is clearly a better made show. 97 was the first one. But even in 97, I found the love triangle really tedious. I mean, I'm biased because I already know that, who she's going to end up with.
Yeah.
But I also, though, I just didn't, what I cared about was much more the fabric of the neighborhood, the funny things that they did together, that teenagers do, that they get into trouble and the silliness and the crushes and the revolving doors of who likes who. That stuff was much more engaging to me. I really, the love triangle was just boring.
It was very predictable too.
Yeah, predictable. I mean, she wasn't going to, well, anyway.
But
to spoil 97 too. But the thing about 88, I felt the same way. Kind of like I wasn't that invested one way or the other. I didn't care who she ended up. In fact, I would have been thrilled if she'd been like, I'm not going out with either of you. I'm going to get on the plane and jet around and meet a rich businessman and get married and live in Shanghai or whatever. I mean,
well, she dated around.
That was an option available to her. She actually got herself a viable career with some glamour to it. She was a pretty young woman. She could have been meeting men literally all over the world. So why is she choosing between these two? Not that they're terrible, but like, she could have, I don't know. It bothered me again. That was sort of like, why are her options so limited? Like, go find somebody else.
Apparently she dated some trash. So I didn't mean that. No pun intended.
You guys, if you're old enough, the original 90210, when Kelly says, I choose me, I would have been amazing if Doksun had
chosen me. Oh, you're looking for too much out of that.
But I wanted it so badly. No, I mean, all kidding aside, it actually did bother me because, again, it was sort of like, oh, you're going to do that stewardess thing, but the really important thing is you got to bury the boy next door. That's much more significant than you being a stewardess. Even though everybody had written her off, everybody had thought she was a loser, and she went and got herself a career. You know, I know Catherine's saying no. I actually think everybody was like, she was like the equivalent of like people saying she has a nice personality to an ugly girl. If for her, it was like, oh, she's really stupid, but she's so sweet and nice. It was a sort of like this consolation prize with her.
I think they had reached a point where they knew that she was not school smart. And I think her mother was legitimately worried, but I do think her mother was also saying, she's bright and she's caring, and her mother was going, but what can she do with that? And
did she give her the drumstick? Did she give her the egg? No, she did not.
But I'd like to take it back to what Melanie mentioned earlier about, you know, the director and the writer maybe being a little off put by the fact that people focus so heavily on the relationship. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, if you're going to do this in three dramas in a series, and that's going to be kind of your thread, that this is one of the things you'll always do who will she end up with? But they envisioned this as 97 is really looking at the individual. It's looking at, you know, a young woman and her relationship with the new first gen K-pop and that. And 94 focuses it's a boarding house in Seoul, and all of these kids come and live at the boarding house, and it's how they create a found family. And then 88 takes us back one more step to this alleyway and this point in Korea's history where you're going to have the changes come. I think it's a really fascinating series to look at it that way. And I can see why they might be disappointed that fans hooked so hard into, you know, the relationships. But, you know, you put your content out and people watch it and take what they want to get from it.
Exactly. That's
the other side. I don't want to be mean, but that was basically the only plot movement was who was going to get together with who. There was no.
Well,
plot.
There was the widow and the widower. They strung that along.
But what I mean is, like, that was the driving force of the drama, was the relationships of who was going to get together, including the adults. Yeah, otherwise, there's no plot. Otherwise,
yeah. I'm good with
you
that.
Know,
I'm not,
you know, like, this is just a personal bias. I can't get into hometown cha-cha-cha. There's definitely like I need to have a little more plot. Like, I loved When the Camellia Blooms, which is a similar setting. It's a small town, but the thing about When the Camellia Blooms is that it's more critical about the abuses that go on in these small communities, and it has positive aspects of those communities, but it also shows you the dark side of the community. So I felt like it was a much more nuanced view, and it had an actual, I mean, they had a serial killer, so it had a plot. But I really have a hard time with these shows that it's where I feel
a hometown happening. Has been showing us some of these elements that you're talking about, Melanie.
Yes, indeed.
I'm just saying.
I can say nothing because
I haven't even watched one. Wrong name. Alyssa, I meant to say Alyssa. Sorry, Melanie, you're in my head.
But yeah, it's, you know, you're right. Everything is through rose-colored glasses with this show. It's showing us this nostalgia. And they're not really, you know, yes, the poor family, Duk-san's family, is going through hard times, and people go through health crises and so forth. But I have to tell you something funny. So the Swoon Instagram feed was doing a retrospective an entire week where they were showing clips on their Instagram feed, reels of clips from Reply 1988, and really celebrating the show. And one of the last episodes, so they show the scene of Duk-san talking about her father and she's crying. And I just was like, oh gosh, but I just saw it. And in the way she was talking about her father, and just, my father was like this and he was like this. And I literally thought that I was seeing a spoiler of his funeral. Okay. And so I was waiting for the other shoe to drop I was like on episode 15 and I had to get to 20. And I'm waiting for this guy this sweet man to die.
Oh, I really thought the same thing.
and so then when it turned out to be this homespun retirement ceremony, I'm like, oh my God, look at what they did. I mean, but I literally, like, that's the point of, like, nothing. You know, only the grandmother passes away. Like, I was expecting something earth-shattering like that to happen, to draw everyone who had dispersed back together or something like that at the end. And instead he just got voluntary retirement, you know. But I hear what you're saying, and I like Hospital Playlist, which is a similar slice of life, and I don't normally necessarily like medical dramas, and it took me a couple of times to watch that one because it's so different than most other dramas, that it wasn't, you know, you have to kind of go into it with the expectation that it is just slice of lot. There's slice of life. There's not going to be a lot of plot. You're just going to have these moments of these friends being together and you just enjoy that. And, you know, they strung that one not only over 20 episodes, but over 2 seasons. You know, I think it's the end. Maybe not. Maybe they will do. They kind of wrapped it up with some of the romantic couples. But it's very, you know, this writer is doing a very different kind of almost her own genre that's very different than other kinds of K-dramas. But she has created worlds that you really want to live in. And I can see, you know, Reply 1988 is one of those. Not all of the nostalgia, not all of the, and I didn't even realize that I should have watched this on Drama Cool. We should mention that a lot of the, even on Viki, things that are shown on TV that are supposed to be of the time or music cues are left out or blurred. So that you don't appreciate all the, I mean, I wouldn't know what shows from the time that they were referencing, but we don't even get to see them. But I guess on Drama Cool, you can. So if I'm going to watch any of the other Reply series, I'm going to seek them out on Drama Cool where all of that stuff is not blurred out. But even so, because I was in high school and college in the 80s, the sound of a dial-up modem or the, you know, the sight of a computer with a floppy disk drive, you know, brings me back to those moments or those simple video games that they're playing at the arcade or the same ones that I was playing. And I always found it interesting. Jung-Wan wants to be a fighter pilot because he's seen the American film Top Gun. Like some of the American references and cultural touch points, how they affected all of their kids. And like one of the movies they all go to see is Forrest Gump, which in a sense is very kind of like Reply 1988, where it's showing all these vignettes and different things of the times and that Forrest Gump goes through all of them, you know, the running craze in the 70s or the 80s and all so forth. So it's an interesting kind of parallel, Forrest Gump and Reply 1988. It's just showing us all these nostalgia moments, touch points, media, books that the kids are reading, shows that they're watching, movies that they're watching that all bring you back to that time.
Well, the other one that we talked about, Melanie, which again, if you're of a certain age, is The Wonder Years.
Yeah.
Which has the same, but I'm not fond of those kinds of shows, but I will say that I do, but like the kind of slice of life, we talked about this too, is like, I loved Kumbalangi Nights, which for those of you who don't know, is a Malayalam film, one of the Indian film industries, and it's about four brothers and their relationship, and it's very slice of life, and yet I freaking love that movie, and it's like one of my top films. I think because I felt like it grappled harder with the ups and downs of a family and like what the downside is of having a family and what they do to you and how they can hurt you, like hurt you in ways that nobody else can hurt you.
And how you can be hurt by living in a small village with other people that are judging you if you're literally living on this side of town where they dump the kittens to die, you know, literally.
Right. Right. So I think what I need is like, if I'm going to get my slice of life, I want it to have a little bit, a tinge of dark.
You want it to be reality.
It doesn't have to be like totally real because reality sucks right now, right? I mean, nobody wants that real, but I don't need that. But I mean, you know, but something just a little bit more textured. And I felt like Reply 1988 was just a little bit of darkness. But what I did love though, and Mel, and you touched on this, was like the minutiae of daily life. I love that part in terms of like how they cooked, how they like in Dokson's family, they are squatting in the kitchen over a concrete sink on the floor. And that's where you do the dishes, the clothes washing, and you're bathing in one room, and how people heated their homes with these charcoal bricks that killed people. And they actually showed that in the show, that they almost died because they almost suffocated to death from the coal fumes, which was a thing. And yet that was considered a big brand new technology, because before that in the village, they were burning wood fires, and you see that in the funeral scene when they cook, they're cooking over open wood fires. So I love that part of it. And also that the wealthy family had a rice cooker, it was a luxury item, you know, and how if you had money, you don't sit on the floor. You have Western style furniture if you have money, but if you're poorer, then everybody's on the floor and your bedding has to be folded up and put away because it's in the main living space. And you're on these thin, very thin futons. So that kind of attention to detail, like whoever did the set design, kudos to the set designer because it was really well done, very well done. And that part of it I did enjoy. I don't know about 20 hours of it, but I did like seeing that part of it.
So go ahead, Catherine. I'm going to open the box at this point because we had a bit of a chat just prior to recording. And one of the upsides for us, I guess, for the reply series is it does allow you to do, I think I mentioned that, you know, if you're introduced to K-dramas through Crash Landing on You, that's a great introduction to the tropes and to this. And the reply series is mostly a great introduction to pop culture. And through the whole series, like the from the media people were consuming to the technology they were using. And we see those shifts, even in the Reply 1988, you see suddenly in 1994, they have beepers. But we kind of discovered, and this is, and Melanie mentioned this, that if the media they're consuming in the show is blurred out, you may not get what's going on. So we had this, Elisa found this reference to Dooley, which was a very popular show at this time and also considered very controversial in this period where they were coming out, you know, from under a dictatorship. But maybe Elisa, you want to take it from here.
Yeah, so there was a post on Reddit just right literally minutes before we were going to go on the air. Saying, should I continue watching Reply 1988 because there's this racist caricature? They refer to, why am I blanking on his name?
Michael.
Michael. No, the one that Melanie has a crush on.
Jen Huang.
Right, it's Jung Hwan, I think, is the one who gets teased for looking like Michael. And Michael is a Korean it's a character who's obsessed with Michael Jackson and wears blackface. and they just make that joke in the show. Like, oh, you look like Michael to the dark skinned kid with the big full lips. It's messed up. And like, we were like talking about this briefly before the show, it was right before the show, to say, the author made a decision to include that joke in the show and to include that show, you know, reference to that character. And I think I feel completely comfortable with calling that out because when you are a writer, you make decisions about what you're going to put in and what you're going to leave out. It's not a documentary, right? You're like making choices about how you want to portray that world. Well, that author chose to include that racist caricature in there. And it's not cool.
No, you're right, because they could have chosen any other point. And now I'm thinking Dooley is also a huge part of It's Okay to Not Be Okay.
Yes.
Ooh, so,
really?
The autistic character loves Dooley, and that's why he's got the dinosaurs, because Dooley is a dinosaur.
See, I totally missed that.
So, but I think, as we were discussing this, I think my point was, this is where, when you start exploring another culture, and I'm not being an apologist for this at all, but this is stuff that you're going to hit, and you have to think about, you know, because we all get really excited and we get on Twitter and we dissect this and we dissect that and we talk about how wonderful this is in Korea and how wonderful that is in Korea. And we all know that Korea is like any other country that has its good points and its bad points. And this is a particularly egregious point. And right. Even if you say, okay, in the context of 1988, when they were making Dooley, that stuff happened. But as you point out, they could have chosen another moment. They could have not made that joke in a show that was 2015?
Around that.
It isn't like a 20-year-old show.
I mean, and there's a difference. If you're going to reference Michael Jackson, I think there is a scene where Rudong Rong character like does a moonwalk or something, because I mean he wants to be a dancer, he wants to be a performer. That's completely different. I mean, this is a one momentary reference. This is not like Backstreet Rookie having an entire blackface character, but still it deserves to be called out.
But we also know that blackface continues to happen in Korea,
right?
And we also know, I mean, I mentioned to you guys that they had done, there's a Dooley Ramen song with Michael in it. And they did that as a skit on Korean Saturday Night Live with A-Pink in blackface. One of the A-Pink singers in blackface. We know that Gag Concert, which is a similar comedy program from KBS, has done blackface. And when they edit their programs to go for international consumption, they take it out.
So they know it's wrong.
They know it's problematic.
They know it, but they do it anyway for the home audience. It's messed up. And, you know, it's very challenging, especially because, first of all, we're not in Korea, right? We're consuming Korean content. And then we are seasoned enough through our Indian content consumption and experiences to understand that fiction is not real life necessarily, right? But it does tell you something about the hopes, dreams, fears, aspirations, and also biases and bigotry of the people that live in the place where this stuff is produced. And, you know, you have to be careful in critiquing, but I feel fully confident to say, take the racist caricature out of the show. And I think it reflects really poorly on the writer and director that was in there. And it reflects really poorly, for example, in the Olympics recently. Remember what happened with the Olympics?
Oh my God.
So NBC, which is like one of the biggest broadcast networks in Korea, did the opening ceremony and came up with these crazy caricatures. Like they showed, what did they show for Haiti? Riots in Haiti. And they showed
Chernobyl for Ukraine
crazy stuff. And I was like, wow. And that's like,
and it came out, it came out that the people working on this at NBC were actually sort of like QAnon equivalent types.
Right.
So you get how it happened, except how does it happen?
Well, like, right, because it isn't like, okay, there's some knucklehead who is a frontline producer who wants to do this, but why isn't there a structure to say, no, you can't do that?
Yeah, and this is not some deep corner of the internet. This is a major TV channel.
It's the equivalent of NBC in the US, you know? And so, yeah, that was really messed up. And so I think it is really challenging. And I had a lot of problems with this show. I know you guys didn't, but I personally really felt like this show was a little bit regressive, because I think it's casting a very nostalgic look back at a time period, which I understand, but it's also like really papering over some very serious things that were going on at that time, and problematic views of women and problematic views of these communities that just kind of got glossed over. And I realize it's a fantasy and it's meant to be lighthearted and give you
but there's choices in how you portray the one full-time working mother in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Right. Oh yes. Okay. Does somebody else want to take it? Or are you gonna let me do it?
Go on.
As a working mother. Because this woman is working, she's successful, her family is well off because of the income she's earning, because her husband's a school principal, so she's the one bringing in the money, and her son decides to run away from home for 2 days, and she doesn't notice, and he comes back all dejected because his mother doesn't notice, and I'm like, bullshit, okay, pardon me, I'm not even going to bleep that out, because I am mad. It was like, I am a working mother, and if my son didn't come home for 2 days, like, I would not know. Give me a break. That really got to me. I was very, and then she had to do penance because he ends up in the hospital. I'm losing track of that plot line.
Yeah, he ended up in the hospital due to hemorrhoids. That was the second time, you know, and it was another time. He stuck garlic. You know, I didn't quite understand. He tried some weird folk remedy with garlic and it did not go well.
But like, you know, she basically is like practically wearing, like, you know, flagellating herself over what a terrible mother she is and how she's going to make him panchan from now on. And, you know, he's going to get home cooked meals. And will you please ever forgive me? And I'm like, everything in that house she bought, his standard of living, the fact that he can afford to go to a good school and get tutoring and all that is because of her income. Like, I just, that whole thing made me rage. So that's just my little hobby horse. I'm going to let it go because otherwise I'll go on for an hour. But yeah, I mean, I definitely, as watching this show, I definitely felt like it was a retro fantasy with all the things that are problematic about a retro fantasy.
Right. Well, she was not one of the main mothers. She was shown as being an sort of an outsider in their little mother friendship group because she wasn't there every day cooking with them. So therefore, she was kind of an outsider.
She didn't have anything to say to them and they didn't have anything. Yeah.
The only thing I will say, I mostly agree with you, but I will say that there is a point where she's looking after her grandchildren and she's with the other mothers. And you can see that this is a woman who is deeply unhappy. They at least gave her that much. Like, she didn't go from not working to suddenly thriving in grandmotherhood. It's the husband who thrives in grandfatherhood. So they at least gave us that. But yeah, I think we started off with an episode about food, and I think where we've ended up is there are so many levels down you can go once you take the opportunity to do that. And I think on some level, I mean, we've talked about this, about learning to at least read Hangul and make an effort to pronounce things better, which is a more respectful opinion or a more respectful kind of approach to things. And, you know, digging down deep into the reply series is another form of respect, but it also comes with some realizations. Like, you have to learn some of this history, otherwise you may not get some of the context of this, and you have to be prepared to confront some cultural things that you're not going to like.
Yeah, I think that's really, really well put, Catherine. And, you know, I think it's totally valid to consume K-dramas solely on the level of, oh my God, these guys are so hot, I can't take it, you know, and we do that.
Yep.
Every day we trade gifts and pictures, and we laugh about Melanie's latest screensaver and our husbands, and I wish you guys could see the So and Gook cutout that Melanie sent me. So, like, definitely enjoy the K-dramas on that level as well. And if you wanted to stop there because the world is a cold, cruel place and you just want pure escapism, I actually am cool. Like, I actually think that's okay. What I don't think is okay, though, is when you fight the idea that there's anything problematic, or you fight the idea that there's a history there that is complex behind it.
What I will give it to this series, this particular K-drama, is that the parental figures are not just there solely to be an obstacle to a love story or to propel the plot in some way. They have their own stories. And that is something that is a little bit unique about this. And even in Hospital Playlist doesn't do this completely, but there is one, you know, widow character that, you know, develops a relationship with another old friend, widower. So we're showing, you know, generations, and they're having their own struggles. And, you know, there's a romance, as we mentioned, between the widow and the widower. It takes a long time to get there, but at least it happened, right? Which in so many other K-dramas, it's totally focused on the teen love or the young adult love. And the parents are just there to bring over the kimchi and find somebody over who shouldn't have been over. And, like, you know, it's okay. It's a plot point, right? It's not that they have fully fleshed out characters and lives of their own. So I will have to give it up to this drama to at least giving us that.
And it's very much Reply 1988 that does that. 1997 and 1994 have so much less of the parents and they're, yeah. and you know, they're very inconsequential on many levels. And that's what I loved about 88 was like, I connected more with the parents.
Right.
And also to piggyback on like what everybody said, for me, I look at it like it's almost a backdrop. It's having good memories in a backdrop of a time that obviously things were not good, you know, and not, or not completely good, where it was hard, you know? And I think that the show, like Melanie mentioned, rose-colored glasses, it's just trying to say that despite that, well, at least that's kind of how I see it, and that's just kind of how I see it in a lot of things, is that despite the circumstances, whether the harsh realities of how they viewed women, whether education-wise, this was a time that they found each other. This was a time where they found home. This was a time they found friendship. This was a time they found love. And I think that sometimes while, you know, everybody kind of sees it on a different perspective, I saw it at least from both perspective, where I know that, yes, there are problematic things. But despite those problematic things, these are people who have found each other, and they're nostalgic, and they're looking at their childhood. And I mean, there's so many things in each and every one of us childhood that was crap, but it doesn't mean that you don't look back at certain things and think, oh my God, wow, life was, you know, there's certain things you look back, you're like, maybe you might want to go back, even though you don't, but you know, you think about certain things that you like about it. And I think Reply 98 just put a whole bunch of things that they liked about it and didn't look at the harsh, which is why maybe the situation with Bora probably was a little glossed over, because they probably just wanted to pinpoint the good things of youth, the things that despite every crappy things that's happening, you're still living, you're still making it, you still have a family, you still have neighbors that are willing to share food, you know, you still have certain things. So for me, I kind of looked at it that way, and maybe that's why it was so memorable for me, because I connected to it, that I didn't really, my childhood was not that perfect, was not that great. And there are many things I hated, just like you, Alyssa, you mentioned, with neighbors knowing everything, aunties all up in your business. A lot of us didn't like that. But despite that, there are people, there are memories that, you know, you get when you eat a certain food, when you, you know, there's certain things that sticks with you. And of course, you're not going to look at the bad part. And so maybe that's what Reply 98 only looked at, the good part of that youth, of the crappy youth that was going, you know, and I think I sleep better at night when I think of it that way. So.
Well, Vicky, you know what I'm really struck by, because as you know, guys know, I'm on Reddit, even though I'm like probably the oldest person on there, because the average age of the people there are like 18 to 25, probably. Yeah. Like our podcast listeners, actually, God bless you for listening to us. So everybody talks about the nostalgia and how it gives them a warm embrace, and how they cry when they watch it because they feel the love, and it's like almost like they have a loving family, they experience a loving family through watching it. So I actually think that's, it wasn't my experience watching it, but I mean, that's great, you know, it's such a lovely thing. And to have that, I think it's definitely, and it sounds like you had that similar thing. And Melanie, we talked a little bit about this, about way maybe there's a generational difference in how people experience this show. Because if you're too young to have actually been living in the era, it'll land differently for you than for us, where we were adults, I mean, in 88. So we remember it in a different way. Not, we weren't in Korea, but
I wasn't in Korea, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Catherine. I think I related more to some of the parental figures and the things that they were going through, and the worries that they had for their children. Yeah, some of that resonated a little too close to the bone for me.
And I think that's the beauty of it. I think that the fact that each and every one of us can watch a show and kind of break it down into different perspective, that's amazing. I mean, everybody see it in a different way. Everybody felt touched in a different way. Everybody perhaps didn't feel touched in a certain way. And I think that Reply 1988 is like a bowl of soup of so many things. And the stories is so many different layers, the parents and then the kids. And so it gave a chance for, I feel like, the audience to relate to something if they wanted to. If you gave yourself that opportunity, or if you wanted to, I think there were some aspects of maybe the parents' life, the children's life, whatever life, you know, even with the little girl, Sun Woo's sister, you know, the one that's always eating the little, and the adults just letting her do whatever. I'm sure somebody felt like that, you know, her. So yeah. I think it just gives a chance for everybody to look at it in a different way.
And also this show was such a launching pad for all of these young actors and actresses. They've all gone on to do so many other things. I'm now, Kyrie, I want to see, she was in the recent Gummy Ho drama that I want to see. And we
haven't seen some,
oh no. And then I know my roommate is a Gummy Ho. I have to see that. And then, we've mentioned at the beginning that some of us are watching Lost because, it's a plot about a male escort starring this guy. Yeah. I'm there. And he may not have won her in the show, but he did in real life. So we have to mention that.
That's all that matters. So Team Jung-won, that's all that matters. Okay.
They've been together so long at this point. It's kind of crazy.
It's beautiful, cute.
But yes, the that is one thing I really liked about it was the cast. Everybody was excellent. Yeah. The acting performances were really, really good in this.
Yeah. Ru Jung-yeol, I mean, he won like the debut actor or something. I don't know exactly what it was, but
debut actor. Yeah.
So he won that for this show. And I mean, I mentioned that he resonated with me partially because my husband was very much like that, like a very shy person that kind of deflected by using sarcasm and would seem harsh, but actually was a marshmallow inside. So maybe that's why I was a Team Jung-won. But anyway, I'm really glad that we all watched this show together. I think this one was such a great one to talk about so many other things and learn more about Korean history, learn about the rapid societal change and why, why it really resonates when someone greets you in a drama, they say, "Have you eaten yet?" And now, you know, I mean, it's like that carries extra meaning for me now. Or the team dinner when somebody says, "I'll take you all out for meat." Now we know a little bit more why that has a resonance and why that's special. Because we do, seeing food in Korean dramas is just shown in a different way and in a different importance than anything that we watch in Hollywood. I think we would all agree on that. And so I've learned more about it through watching this drama and all the background research that we did, thinking about putting together this particular podcast episode.
I want to say that even though I didn't have the same reaction to this as everybody else, I'm really glad I watched it. I feel like it has completely changed my lens of how I watch a lot of different K-dramas. And I feel like I understand some things more. And it is really, because, you know, you have things like DP, Squid Game, Sweet Home. They all touch on a lot of the same things that Reply 1988 touches on, but like with a different lens. It's like a much darker lens, but the issues and the thing about, you know, community and being fed kingdom touches on food in a really weird way. So being able to like dive into the show, now I'm kind of like going, oh wow, it's kind of like opening my eyes to a very different way to look at all of it. So thank you guys. I think we're done, right?
I think so.
So this was amazing, as I always knew it would be, because you guys are awesome. I can't believe that we've been able to keep this going. It's very exciting for me, and I love you guys. Finger hearts. This is so much fun. And to you listeners who are on every continent except for Antarctica, we're going to get that Antarctica listener eventually. Thank you so much for staying with us. We love you.
You should
too.
Just hashtag it next time I see you.
Yeah, Antarctica, listen to us. But anyways, thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.